Hello, this is Julianne Good, and welcome to Psych 101. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you, your family, and friends to make your lives easier. Tonight, my special guest is Dr. Melody Bacon, and I'm thrilled to have her back. She has been on several of my shows and is outstanding on giving information that is very usable and very reliable. So, Dr. Bacon, thank you so much for being on. How are you?
Oh, great to be on. Thank you for having me.
So can you tell the audience a little bit about your background?
Yes, I'm a clinical psychologist. I specialize in relational issues and life transition issues. And I also am the campus director of the Irvine branch for the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. And prior to that, I was the chair for the marriage and family therapy programs on the three campuses. So very involved in our field, both from a clinical setting and an academic setting.
Yes, you are. It's very impressive. So thank you for doing all the work that you've done. You've made a huge impact over at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology.
Well, thank you.
So tonight we're going to be talking about divorce and divorce recovery, since statistics in this country say that half of the people that get married are going to get divorced. So it's a good thing to have some recovery tools and to kind of understand the process a little bit more about what you're going to go through when you get divorced, because it's a hard time for a lot of people. Now, Dr. Bacon, how did you get involved in writing a book called The Grace-Filled Divorce? What's your background on authoring this book?
Yeah, I actually just had somebody ask me that just the other day. He asked me if I'd actually gone through one myself, which I think was a good question, and the answer is no. I actually was widowed at a fairly early age, in my early 30s, and that is part of the story of this book, which kind of occurred as my friends were starting to get divorced, and we were comparing notes, so to speak, and I had been through my grief process and noticed that there were a lot of similarities, but there were no rituals, there was no validation of grief and loss for the person getting a divorce. Often people would be asked shortly, even before they were divorced, are you dating anybody yet, as though they'd broken up with somebody they were dating in high school for 2 months. So that started me on a journey to understand divorce in general and the grief process in particular in divorce. And so during my doctoral program at Pacifica Graduate Institute, I focused my research on that particular topic, and it also lent itself well into my work as a clinical psychologist, because as you mentioned, a lot of people unfortunately do go through this experience, and if they don't personally go through it, they've had their parents go through it, or their siblings, friends. It's just one of those unfortunately sad factors of life that marriages are very difficult for many people to keep together for a variety of reasons. And the aftermath of that can be very traumatic. It can go on for years. I just heard about a couple who have been divorced 14, 15 years. They're adult son is still dealing with the aftermath of that, and the couple is still, believe it or not, in a legal battle with each other.
Wow, after 14, 15 years?
Yes. You kind of want to say, why'd you bother getting a divorce? I mean, you could be fighting for 15 years and be married, so.
Yeah, exactly. Well, especially legalities after that long, too.
Yeah.
You have to wonder what caused that it got so complicated.
Yeah, well, certainly you have to have the money, unfortunately, to go through that. But also, people may be legally divorced and not monetarily divorced, and they're still tied to each other. And that complicates anything else they're going to do later on, which is one reason why second marriages have a higher divorce rate than first, upwards of 75%.
Wow.
Because so many of the issues from the first marriages blend into the second ones, and now you're trying to blend a family. And so that's why, as you said earlier, this is a very common issue, but it's very complicated.
Well, especially since I think a lot of people are under the myth that, okay, they're going to get married a second time, it's going to be better, I learn my lesson. And from what you said, maybe they haven't learned their lesson yet, and they're maybe in rebound mode. They're wanting to find somebody to get attached to the next time so that they can just forget all the misery that they just went through with their first marriages.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Most people make the mistake of thinking that they married the wrong person the first time around. What I hear a lot is, well, we were very young, we didn't know what we were doing, and all that may be true. However, I still believe that you marry somebody for some reason other than what you think it is. I think that marriages actually force us to grow ourselves, and I think that's a good thing if we can look at it that way. In ways that our families of origin also were asking us to grow ourselves, but we're young and helpless and don't have the opportunity to make those changes until we're adults and get married. So people make the mistake of thinking, I picked the wrong person, I'll get divorced, and I'll start over, and this time I'll pick the right person, which kind of makes sense. If that were the case, however, the second marriages would have a far lower divorce rate, and people would be much happier. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, the opposite is the case. And as you noted, Julie, it's often that they didn't know what they needed to learn about themselves before they started in another relationship. And you're right, people do tend to move very quickly in order to assuage their understandable hurt, their fear of being alone. And many times, many of the same problems that drove them into getting married in the first place often are still there and cause them to rebound and quickly attach to somebody else without really assessing, how did I get to this place and how do I avoid doing that in the future?
Right. And who really wants to do the first mistakes in the first marriage?
That's right.
Not I.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was married just for a brief amount of time. It was technically about 5 years. And then I needed a breather. But I also found out, though, I had gotten into a long-term relationship after that, and that there were some things that hadn't quite healed up from the first the first time around.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, that's often without really having a third party to kind of review this with, who's been trained to help, a counselor, trained therapist, it's very difficult because we can't see what we can't know. You know, if we're not, we may know that there's something here that I want to know about myself, but I don't even know how to start looking because all I know is what I'm aware of. And so that's what makes therapy so helpful, is you have someone that can guide you through the process of self-exploration and discovery so that you do come out of these very painful times benefiting in the long run, which is, you know, redeeming in many ways of that kind of suffering.
Right. So in your clinical experience, what are some of the processes that a divorced person comes in with that they really need to start sifting through to get to that place of personal growth?
Yeah, well, as I said, I think the first step that somebody can take would be to find an experienced counselor who really understands the process of divorce and also marriage in a way that can help you learn from your prior marriage. And in many ways, I counsel people in continuing to learn from their ex-spouse. most people have children with their first spouse, and they do continue a relationship with them through their children, and to use that as an opportunity to learn how to respond differently and those types of things. So I think a good therapist, someone who can coach you through different responses, you know, in a growth-promoting way is very helpful. I note in my book that grief and divorce and the experience of divorce is a little bit complicated because it depends on whether or not you initiated the divorce or were the non-initiator, and even that's a little bit difficult to tell sometimes who's who. But in the most simplistic terms, the initiator is someone who has been dissatisfied and very unhappy and feeling very lonely and discouraged for a long time in their marriage, and finally comes to the point at which they are done. They've tried everything they can. Perhaps their spouse is completely uninterested in going to counseling, or if they're unfortunately using drugs or alcohol, not, you know, discontinuing that and getting into some kind of recovery. So you have that person who has to go through a lot of the grief and pain while they're married. And so by the time they're done with the marriage, they have processed a lot of that, even though it often surprises people who do initiate a divorce how much sadness they still have to process. And then there are those who probably on some level know their marriage isn't all that great, but for whatever reason, they're not as miserable as the initiator. And so when they're told, I want a divorce, they're kind of shell-shocked, and they have a different experience afterward, often doing a lot of bargaining and you know, pleading and trying to get the person not to leave.
It's like the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stages of death.
Very much so. It's much more similar for the non-initiator because of the unexpected quality of it. And so sometimes people will find, if you ask someone, did they have any grief after their divorce, somebody might say, no, I was just happy. But if you explore further and say, well, how about during your marriage? Oh, yeah, you know, I was, you know, really unhappy and lonely. That's the initiator's experience. But as you rightfully noted, the non-initiator then has a different process and often kind of envies the initiator who seems to be moving on blissfully, even though that's really not the case usually. But they certainly are in a different phase of grief. So to understand that, you are going to, one way or the other, need to grieve the loss of the marriage, maybe not as the way it was, but as the one that you hoped it would be. The intact family you wanted to have, the lifelong marriage, the dreams, the hopes, all the things that were tied up in that marriage, there needs to be a time period of grieving, and that kind of will come up periodically at different times for different people and different situations. And my experience is people really short-circuit that because it does hurt, and most of us don't really like feeling pain, and so we do what we can to quickly get rid of it. But in so doing, that pain doesn't go anywhere. It just goes underground, and I think that accounts for the vitriolic kinds of legal battles that we often hear about and the ongoing issues that then negatively affect future relationships and your children and yourself.
Right. And as being an initiator, the person may feel relief for doing that and finally go, okay, great, I can just put this behind me. This was a huge mistake. But then, you know, the shame comes, the guilt comes, the heavier processing of the deeper emotions, just trying to deal with all that can be pretty complicated too.
Very.
And then of course, the husband or the wife is going to look at the other person as being the bad guy.
Yep.
And also the family and the friends. How could you possibly have done this? And
that's right.
Right. And then all of a sudden you have people taking sides, and that can get really ugly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think you're right. There's initial, for the person who's initiated in particular, there's a relief, almost like a claustrophobic person kind of getting out of a claustrophobic situation. But then, as you said, the dust settles. Most people do feel guilty about the pain they've inflicted, and then shameful in that often comes up in feeling like a failure. Other people can make it work. I couldn't. And then, as you said, sometimes that also gets conveyed through family, friends, kids. And if somebody is in certain religious traditions where there's a proscription against divorce, so that's a big load to carry in trying to move through successfully. And again, not processing it with someone really makes it almost impossible, because these are such fundamentally large feelings and very difficult. You really need someone that can walk alongside you and help you get through to the other side.
Right. It's very helpful. Mm-hmm. Got to have some support while you're going through the process.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's another option as well. There are divorce recovery support groups that can be helpful if they're, particularly if they're facilitated by a licensed therapist. I found that sometimes the non-facilitated groups end up dissolving fairly quickly because people start, you know, getting together romantically and they become less helpful. But if you have one that's time limited, you know, usually they're about 8 weeks, you know, a lot of churches will do that, and you don't have to be affiliated with that religious tradition to go. But they will have a very structured format, and it can be very helpful to be with other people who are going through the same thing and not feeling, you know, so alone in the whole process.
Yeah, because to sit there and isolate on it, it just makes the pain worse.
It does. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think to go through any pain alone is probably the worst that you can do to yourself, and it's a natural response for many people because of the shame. And often my clients will look around and see other people and say, well, everybody's doing okay, but nobody advertises, you know, on their shirt sleeve, you know, I've had a horrible day, or I just left my spouse, or my spouse just left me. People present an okay look to the world, but the truth of the matter is you just don't know the pain that anybody is going through or has gone through. And that's where a support group can be so helpful, because it kind of takes away some of that stigma that you're the only one, and you know, other people are being successful at something that you haven't been able to somehow manage to succeed at. And I think the other component to that is, you know, reading books can be very helpful as well. I think there's a combination of things of, you know, reading about other people's experiences and how they got through something can really help you to, first of all, not feel so alone and to have a little bit of a roadmap going through. Going to a support group and then going to a good counselor, all of that can make sure that you move through the divorce process successfully, and then if and when you are ready to begin another relationship. And most people will tell me initially, oh, I'll never do that again. But 80% of people who divorce do, at least, you know, whether they remarry or just become romantically involved again, will. And so it's a way of kind of preparing yourself to move forward on a lot of levels. And in my book, a lot of the people I interviewed were amazed at how that process that I just described of support group, of counselor, of self-exploration through reading and journaling, actually opened up other areas of their lives. Many of the women I interviewed ended up in different careers, getting education that they hadn't planned on. And that was an unexpected outcome of having done the hard work of self-exploration and self-development, but it was, you know, a really nice outcome that people celebrated.
Right. I can attest to that one. My life took off after I got divorced, and it was a while, but, but it's moved in such positive directions that, you know, I don't think I could have done that within the marriage that I was in. So, but at least I've got that insight now. It took a while to get there, but it's really possible. I agree with you.
Oh, yeah, and I think to allow yourself the time to do that, because it's like anything else. There's not a specific time frame. You know, we'd like to have one, but that's not the way it works. And I will say that it's an interesting phenomenon that in our culture, there's kind of this, maybe not so common now, but certainly years ago, the assumption that women are chasing men to get married and men don't want a ball and chain around their ankle. But the truth of the matter is that men will not stay single very long after, whether they're widowed or divorced. They don't do well, for the most part, being single. And so when I was doing my research for my dissertation, which later became my book, I ended up focusing on women just because it was too difficult to find a man who was single for more than a year after their divorce. And that's not a judgment, about men in our society. It's just an interesting phenomenon.
It is, and I bet a lot of people don't know that information.
No, they don't. Yeah, and there are also a lot of statistics about men health-wise, and you know, single men don't do as well physically either. So
true.
It's if one can at least commit to a certain length of time after your divorce, and we all know that for some people, divorce isn't all that quick. I mean, even if you don't have an acrimonious divorce, you need at least six months from the time you file. And I always advise my clients to at least wait the 6 months until the divorce is final before they start to go to a meetup group or some other Match.com or eHarmony or something. I understand that it's nice to know that you're still attractive, and people often get on these sites to see if anybody would even want to go out with them. But the problem with that is most of the time, yes, there are people who want to date. And when you haven't even gotten your divorce final, it's very hard to start a new relationship when you're in the middle of all that emotional upheaval. And it usually doesn't work out very well for either one of the parties.
Right. It's not too pretty in some circumstances.
Right.
Yeah, most definitely. Okay. Dr. Bacon, we're going to come back after we take this brief musical break. And let's talk about when people are planning on getting married. What are the concepts behind getting married nowadays? I mean, that would be really interesting to kind of dig into the viewpoints and see where we're coming from in America.
Great.
Okay.
Wonderful.
to Psych 101 with Julianne Good and Dr. Melody Bacon. We are discussing divorce recovery. And before the break, I was asking Dr. Bacon about what are the viewpoints now on marriage? Are we still going into being married with almost rose-colored glasses on, or are we really looking at what we're getting into most of the time? What would you say, Dr. Bacon?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, it's interesting that while I was doing my research on divorce, I wanted to find out about what's been done in terms of marriage and preparing people for that very reason. You know, how do you prevent divorce? And, in fact, I had done, with my husband, who's a marriage and family therapist, we had done a number of workshops that we called Before You Pop the Question. We were trying to reach people prior to them even getting engaged to help them be more prepared for marriage. And it was a tough sell. I was surprised, actually, given the fact that, as we talked earlier, the divorce rate is so high. Most people have gone through some aspect, whether it's their own divorce or their parents or someone they know. And so we thought this would be a great, people would jump at the chance to examine their relationship before they got married. And I know I remember talking to a young woman about her engagement and then suggesting that that she and her fiance come, and she said, well, I don't want to find out that we shouldn't be getting married, which kind of surprised me, because you certainly don't want to find that out after you've gotten married.
Exactly. Let's do it before.
But it is a fear. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the funny thing is, you're right, the rose-colored glasses are still alive and well. Now, some people have decided that they just won't get married. They'll live together and have more of a common law relationship and have children and buy homes. And that gives its own set of difficult circumstances. And the reality is, if you split up under those circumstances, it's no more emotionally easy, and you have a little bit more complications because you have children and you have property. So there's no getting around the fact that people want to be together, and they're resistant to preparing for it because they want to believe that, especially when you're in the throes of romantic love, that this will get you through anything. And I wish that were true.
Right.
But it isn't enough. It's, of course, you have to start with that. But I think being conscious in your intention as you're dating, as well as you're determining, you know, how you want to move forward with any individual, is the only way to mitigate some of the negative issues that come up with any relationship, and prepare yourself for them. So in my practice, I use an assessment that's called PREPARE, and it's taken online. Each individual takes it separately, and then they meet with a counselor for several sessions to review the results. And what this does is show the growth aspects, areas of the relationship, as well as the strengths. And it goes over family of origin issues, as well as religious faith and financial, and all the components that come into what expectations each might have, what issues they may have already faced that they haven't really resolved. And that can be a very strengthening process. I've done this a number of times with individuals who, you know, really find the process very, you know, optimistic and growth-promoting, and it gives them a nice foundation for marriage based on a real experience with each other, as opposed to, you know, hope and a prayer. And so there are those kinds of options for people that want to move forward a little bit differently. The other thing that I found, I assumed that second marriages would, you know, that people would be more likely to want to prepare for those. And unfortunately, because I think most of them think they just married the wrong person, they're not any more likely than first marriages to go through, three or four sessions of counseling to make sure that they know, you know, what they're getting into with each other. And it's too bad because most of the time it's really more of an inoculation by which you kind of know ahead of time two or three issues that you're probably going to face or what might happen when you when your relationship gets a lot of stress, whether it's unemployment or sickness or anything like that, so that when that does happen, you can say, okay, we knew this would happen. We knew this would be the challenge. You're less likely to think of it as, uh-oh, you know, we've got a big problem and we made a mistake.
Right, and then all of a sudden the relationship collapses and you're just going, okay, I'm a failure and
yes.
Here we go again. And instead of really locking into all those skills that they learned within those 3 to 4 sessions, I think that's a very small amount of time to contribute to building a positive base.
That's right.
To a successful marriage.
You're right. It is. I mean, you know, when you, I don't know if you've ever watched some of these bride shows that are on reality TV, you know, but the amount of money that people are spending on weddings,
that's stupendous.
You know, it's just tens of thousands of dollars.
Yes.
And when you think that really the wedding isn't the point, you know, it's the marriage is what is really the important thing. And what kind of a marriage are you going to have, as you said, 3 to 4 sessions with a trained clinician? The prepare costs $30, so that's nothing. You may be talking $500, you know, max. I often advise parents, if you want to give your kids a great wedding gift, pay for them to have a prepare assessment done.
Yes.
And like I said, I've done this many times with couples, and it gives them an opportunity to talk in a way that maybe they haven't before. It gives them an opportunity to really stand back and look at their own families, at each other's families, and by the time they walk down the aisle, they've really done everything they could to make sure that they're going to have a strong and lasting marriage, and that's the best you can say. You know, I mean, there's no guarantees, even with the prepare, which gives you a kind of an assessment whether you're in a very strong position to get married or maybe you should think twice about it. And actually, I have most of the time the people that I do the assessment with are in of what they call vitalized, which is the strongest assessment you can get. But once in a while, I'll get somebody who's the lowest, which is called conflicted, which means that they're already having a lot of conflict. And even that can be successful, though. I had a couple who had actually gone through one of our trainings, and I don't remember if they were quite that low, but we did an initial assessment before they started the workshop, and they had quite a few issues. And as we were going through the workshop, he was learning more about his family of origin. He'd never thought about them. He'd never thought about how people did things in his family. And you could just see all these light bulbs going on. And he went back and visited them, and he started really a whole process of self-discovery and learning, and he was very excited about it. And, of course, his fiance was thrilled. And I saw them a couple of years later, and he'd continued on with that, and she was just delighted. I'm sure by the end of the workshop, if they'd taken that assessment again, they would have been much higher. And so, you know, there's hope even in that if one or both of them takes advantage of it.
Yeah, that's wonderful to just go through that prepare process.
Yep.
And then find out where those hidden that hidden information comes out.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, what a wonderful success story on it.
Yeah.
You know, because who knows until you really start searching through your history about what you may be bringing into the relationship from your family of origin, which most of us do. Mm-hmm. Most of us go through that process of we need to heal up something from our family of origin.
It's kind of like our language, you know, our native language. We don't really think about how we learned it, but we just speak it. And, sometimes we come into a relationship with a certain relational language, so to speak, not knowing that this is maybe not the best way to handle something. This is just the way people did things.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing when you're going through a relationship and you're in the midst of conflict and something will pop out of your mouth and you're thinking, I can't believe I just said that. That's what my parents had said 30 years ago, and it just popped out of my mouth because I'm under stress and duress, and my subconscious is letting loose right now, and so is my mouth.
Yes. My husband always says that's where your brain got wired, was in your family of origin.
Yes.
So to rewire it by going back and trying to be different with them and maybe observing them, see, well, how do people do conflict in my family? Do they just get real quiet and try to ignore things and move away from each other so they don't have conflict? Or do they fight a lot and get into each other's business and tell each other how to live their lives? And, you know, you can often get people from both sides of those spectrum marrying each other. And, you know, it kind of balances out initially. The person that tends to get quiet keeps conflict from getting too heated. And the other one that'll stir it up will keep the relationship from getting too cold. But over time, they get polarized, and that's usually what I see in my practice, is there's somebody who comes from a family where the default is we just don't have conflict, but we have a lot of distance, marrying to somebody who's family has a lot of conflict, but unfortunately, you know, that can be painful and wounding in its own way. And so knowing those things going in can really help prevent a lot of that unnecessary heartache and help you learn how to change a default that you don't even know you have.
Right. So being able to have that insight and stopping yourself in those tracks when you see it going into the same fight, flight, conflict area.
That's right.
And
exactly.
Challenging it, saying, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. This is not getting us anywhere. This is pulling us apart. This is causing more conflict. This is bringing up stuff from my childhood that I thought it was long gone, long buried, and I, you know, don't want to have anything to do with it. So just being able to stop and sometimes just take a deep breath and not blurting out, not adding to that conflict. Maybe taking a deep breath and saying, okay, this is what I'm feeling right now. I'm feeling it instead of like projecting it out and saying you're the one to blame for my pain.
That's right. Yeah. I think a lot of what I teach my clients is managing their own brain. And the fight, flight, or freeze part, they call the limbic system, that one takes over pretty easily when we're in pain or conflict, to the point where the part of our brain that does the thinking starts to shut down. And as you said, if you can take a deep breath, quiet yourself, maybe take a little bit of a break from whatever is the discussion, because arguing and yelling, as we all know, just doesn't solve anything. It only wounds and hurts. Conflict can be helpful if you can have it in a way that you're actually learning something about the other person and yourself, but that requires a lot of availability of your thinking part and a lot of calmness, and that's where the challenge is. How do you learn how to be less what we call reactive, which is just kind of hair trigger, you know, somebody has an eyebrow raised and I'm already at a 10 in terms of my anger. And so this is where sometimes close relationships can really be challenging. However, the flip side is when you're willing to do that kind of work and really hold on to yourself and try to be as aware and as you can have a much more truly deep and intimate relationship with another human being, and that's really worth all that effort in the long run.
Yes, it is. Just holding on to yourself. It was what was a snarch?
Mm-hmm. A passionate marriage.
Yes.
And you would call it holding on to yourself, which is, you know, not being curious about your partner, not trying to get convince them to change their mind and you know, change, but at the same time not necessarily just capitulating because they're upset or angry or you know, sad. That's holding on to who you are and really acting out of your values. So I do a lot of work with people to get clear on your deeply held values, which can take some time, and sometimes they can feel like they're in conflict with each other, but ultimately, when you have a values-based response, you're much less likely to argue with someone about it because it's a deeply held value of yours, not willing to give that up. And so, yeah, that kind of that idea of being me with you. And, you know, getting back to our original discussion on divorce, people often feel like they can truly be who they are with the person that they're eventually married. However, things then change, and the theory that I work from, Bowen Family Systems, would say that's because once you're married, that person is now a member of your family, and you start to, over time, treat each other like your family, which, however that was growing up, is how you'll, you know, tend to replicate. And that's why I like to know a lot about a person's family of origin, not to point fingers and to say, you know, anything negative, but to really say, let's just look at the information. Let's look at the strengths that you are bringing into this relationship with, and let's look at some of the challenges on both parties. And then what do you, each of you, need to work on, which is often different, but, you know, that relationship is going to kind of be the catalyst for change in a way that almost no other relationship will replicate, except for maybe the parent-child one. And even that can sometimes be less intense because at some point, if you're doing your job, your child is going to leave home and move on into their own life. Whereas if you're married, the idea is you're going to stay married long after that. And so there's a little bit more intensity in marriage because so much of your life is intertwined.
It is, especially if you have children, then it becomes mm-hmm. even more complicated.
Yep, that's right.
And yeah, and the beautiful thing nowadays is that we have so much information out there on how to create healthy relationships.
Mm-hmm. We do.
And it's just so much more than our own parents had.
Absolutely.
So I think as a society, we need to understand that now. If you came from a dysfunctional family system, you do not have to repeat that.
That's right.
You can
That's right.
go out and get the information if something is just not sitting right and mm-hmm. it's gnawing away at you. You can go out, get some information, go get the personal therapy, go do the group therapy, even before, hopefully, before you even split up. If you're having marital issues, mm-hmm. go do couples counseling. Go get the life anchor and go get some new set of tools and a third-person perspective on how you can save your relationship.
Right, yeah. And you actually, even if your partner won't go, I've had many people make significant changes in their lives without their partner participating. They generally didn't have a really negative partner who was, you know, actively being abusive. But they were the one that was motivated to make some shifts in the dynamics of their family and how they were behaving. and to a very good, I mean, I had a man who was in, came in actually because his son was having panic attacks, and he disclosed that he was too, and he thought maybe he would come in as well, and that we ended up working a lot on his relationship with his wife and his children, to the point where his wife came in one day and just was thrilled because, you know, their relationship had just blossomed. And I never really worked with her. So, you know, it doesn't always mean that if you go in on your own, you will be able to save your marriage. We don't know going in what will happen. But we certainly know that you don't have to wait for the other person to be willing to come in order to make some changes.
Right, and try to go in early enough where it's not to the point of crisis, where you are looking to the counselor to be the judge as to whether or not you should stay together as a couple. Because
you're right.
I think a lot of couples come in at that point. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of liken it to cancer. And, you know, one of the things in our society that's been so wonderful in the medical field is the fact that we can treat cancer when it's at stage zero.
Wow.
And as a result, people can get breast cancer in particular. When it's stage zero, then, you have a very minimal treatment. You get rid of it. You're cancer-free. As opposed to stage four, where now you've got hugely invasive and you know, deleterious kinds of treatments just to keep you alive, if you will even, you know, even that be the outcome. And as you noted, most people, unfortunately, in their marriage come in at stage four. They're kind of flipping the coin and saying, okay, do we go to an attorney or do we go to a therapist? And that makes it very difficult, if almost impossible, which is why one of the reasons why the outcomes for couple therapy is poor, because people do wait so long. That being said, I have been privileged to work with clients who had the wherewithal to come in earlier. I worked with a couple who hadn't even been married a year yet, and she came in initially, and then he did. They both changed very quickly. And I asked her what made her decide to come in so soon, because it's very unusual. Well, she had gone into therapy in her teens and, of course, that hadn't been very meaningful to her, so it didn't even occur to her not to go in when she realized she was having some issues with her husband. Things turned around very quickly because they still had a lot of goodwill and love and respect, and it was a matter of fine-tuning things as opposed to trying to resurrect something that maybe is dead and gone already.
Yeah, and it was early in the process.
Yep.
Because
yep.
A lot of people don't realize that the first 1 or 2 years of marriage can be the roughest, because you're trying to make that transition and learning compromise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most divorces, actually the majority, occur in the second year of marriage, which kind of goes against our mythology of the first year kind of being this blissful honeymoon period. But when you consider you need at least 6 months in order to get a divorce, that first year had to have been a very tough one for someone to be, you know, divorced by their second year. So you're right. The first year, people don't understand that it is challenging. And yet, if people will be open to coming in and seeking counsel, not only will you have change more quickly, you'll set the foundation for a strong marriage, because the skills that you learn will be skills that you'll keep throughout your life. And you don't have to go for as long, because, you know, everything changes so much more quickly. But we have this resistance because people are ashamed to go in. They think everybody else is just doing it. Like I said, we tend to look at everybody else and think that they're doing fine, and that's not the case. They're just hiding when somebody says, how are the lovebirds or the honeymooners doing? And mm-hmm. You're not going to say, well, we've had this huge fight and, you know, he's staying out every night and we're miserable. You know, most people are like, fine, fine, you know, we're doing fine.
Denial.
But obviously they're not.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I think that's, you know, if people could overcome their reluctance, you know, it used to be 150 years ago, people wouldn't go to the dentist because, you know, mainly all they did was pull your teeth. And as dental care got better, they've been able to turn things around to where people will go in when there isn't a problem. And I think to have that kind of mindset with the marriage, which is, well, let's not wait until things are bad. If we've gone around and around about an issue enough to where we realize we're really stuck, let's go into someone, review it, deal with it, learn something, and move on. Much like you would if your car was acting up or, you know, you felt like maybe you had a cavity. You know, I think if we could get it less stigmatized to go in and get some coaching, I think, you know, you'd see a much higher success rate of marriages and happier marriages. Even those that stay together aren't always happy.
Yes, I highly agree. That's some great advice. So do preventative intimate relationship care. That's the key.
Yeah, so, don't wait too long.
Right, exactly. So, Dr. Bacon, can you tell the audience how they can order your book, The Grace-Filled Divorce? We've
Absolutely.
Got a couple minutes left.
Yeah, certainly it's on Amazon. There's a Kindle version as well as the paperback. If you want a hard copy, you can also go on my website, thegracefilleddivorce.com. And I'd be happy to send you a copy and autograph that for you as well. So those are the three main ways to get the book, and I would love to have your listeners purchase it and let me know what they think. I'm available on my blog anytime. They can make comments, ask questions. I'm always happy to help in any way.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Bacon.
You're so welcome.
I always appreciate you being on, so...
always a pleasure.
We look forward to having some more shows with you.
Super. That would be wonderful.
Yes, thank you very much, Dr. Melody
Bacon.
And if the listeners would like to contact me, my email address is jgoode8@verizon.net. My office number is 562-234-4650. I have an office in Cerritos, California. Please contact me if you would like to set up a session or if you have any show ideas or comments. I would love to hear them. That would be wonderful. I would like to thank my board operator, Jenny Guzman. Did a great job, girl. The executive producer, Jeremy Hansen. Thank you so much for keeping Skid Row Studios on the air and strong. And if you would like to see me on video, Psych One-on-One is also at therapycable.com. That is a great source for many therapy videos on various subjects with various providers. So go check that out also. I would like to thank you so much for tuning in. If you would like to tune into any other previous programs, Psych One-on-One is on the podcast area of iTunes. And also we have at skidrowstudios.com, we have a whole library of Psych One-on-One shows and also other shows that are very interesting. Please stay tuned to the Qumran Report right on after me. So this has been Julianne Good for Psych One-on-One. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Bye now.